promoting scientific research and discovery in respect, as we should, we must also be alert to the equal and opposite danger that public policy could itself become the captain of a scientific, technological elite.
We've signed a climate convention on the importance of economic instruments and free markets. Were included in this mammoth Agenda 21 document and the Rio Declaration. Now, let me be clear on one fundamental point. The United States fully intends to be the world's preeminent leader in protecting the global environment.
Coming up, Technocracy News. Welcome to Technocracy News and Trends. I'm Patrick Wood, Editor-in-Chief. Today is June 20, 2019, and I wonder how many people understand that the Green Agenda is global, not simply local. I wonder how many people equate it to sustainable development and the 2030 Agenda and the New Urban Agenda, for that matter. I wonder how many people understand truly that this is technocracy in action, the science of social engineering, the engineering of the entire society and all of the people in it. Not just in our country, not just in China, not just in Europe, not just in Africa, but in every country on the planet. This ideology has spread. It's infected every nation, all 197 plus nations of the world. We can thank the United Nations for being the agent to spread this to the world. But the ideology itself, we can trace back very clearly through the auspices of the Trilateral Commission, which was started in 1973 by David Rockefeller and Zbigniew Brzezinski. We can follow it back beyond that to Columbia University, where in 1932, 1933, 1934, the entire movement of technocracy was established. It was created, written down, documented, and established. And for a period of time, it was wildly popular in the United States and Canada. There were serious problems with it, but we won't digress to that right now. The story today is going to start with Australia, and I'm going to show you some of the global nature of technocracy and what's happening today in the world. A reader of Technocracy News and Trends and a writer from Australia has written an article that I reposted under the title, How to Create a Country with No Heart. We look at America today. We see the same problem. America has lost its heart. What made America great is no longer seen anymore in public life. And this is noted on the farthest place away from America, that is down in Australia. That's why they call it the Down Under. This article starts out and it's just so clear. It says, anti-development policies, land use sterilization, climate alarmism, and green lawfare are destroying the future for our kids and grandkids. Current policies will stack and pack the coasts and major cities, leaving the depopulated outback to uncontrolled floods and droughts, lantana and woody weeds, wild cats and dogs, wildfires, feral pigs, and the occasional park ranger or tourist bus. What has happened to Australia's once bipartisan policies favoring decentralization? Why is every proposal to develop an outback mine, dam, irrigation scheme, or real power station now labeled controversial by the ABC and opposed by the ALP Greens? This coastal city focus and hostility to the new outback industry, except for wind and solar toys, has surely reached its zenith with the recent state budget for Queensland. I encourage you to read this entire article, because it goes on to describe how the breadbasket of Australia is being destroyed. And the article notes, it is the outback that produces most of Australia's food, minerals, energy, water, exports, and jobs. And it produces serious income for state governments addicted to ever-rising taxes and royalties. But that doesn't matter to the Greens. The Greens are in process of destroying the breadbasket of Australia, just as they have done in other nations of the world. These same forces, for instance, in California, have destroyed the agricultural industry in the San Joaquin Valley in central California. This used to be one of the greatest breadbaskets of the West, and now it's been decimated by the Greens, who have changed policies, who have deprived farmers of water needed to grow the crops and trees. This is insanity. My comment on this article is take a lesson in the ultra-radical anti-human green agenda. It is the identical story in every nation seen here in Australia. It isn't communism or fascism, but rather it's technocracy, the science of social engineering. Anybody who has read either one of my books, Technocracy Rising, The Trojan Horse of Global Transformation, or my latest book, Technocracy, The Hard Road to World Order, will instantly recognize these policies that we're talking about here today. Australia is being ravaged by the green insurrection. If it's not stopped, the country will suffer greatly and irreparable damage eventually. Within the same story, my second story that I posted on Technocracy News is titled Anatomy of a Failed Solar Power Project, a, quote, large taxpayer-funded pile of scrap, close quote. That's what the article says about it. Article number one, which was How to Create a Country with No Heart, referenced this particular power project, which is a large solar power plant established to create alternative energy, and it ended up to be a total disaster. The article says it was supposed to supply cheaper, greener energy to up to 5,000 homes, but after 6 years and tens of millions of dollars, a cutting-edge solar energy project has produced nothing other than a large, taxpayer-funded pile of scrap. 3,000 solar panels sit unused on a concrete pad after the pioneering Cogan Creek Solar Boost Project was shelved due to rusting pipes and, quote, rapidly moving clouds. Now the site manager alleges the Commonwealth and Queensland governments breached their contractual requirements by never inspecting the doomed $105 million project. Run by French nuclear group Areva for Queensland, state-owned power utility CS Energy, the project was designed to increase efficiency and reduce carbon emissions at the coal-fired Cogan Creek Power Station near Chinchilla. The plan had been to use thousands of mirrors to focus solar energy to preheat steam to drive power-generating turbines. The technology's inventor, Australian scientist Dr. David Mills, in 2014 received an Order of Australia for his work on solar power from the Abbott government. But CS Energy scrapped the unfinished scheme last year, blaming technical and contractual problems. It won't reveal exactly how much it cost, but recorded a $70 million impairment in its 2016 accounts because of the scheme. Half that amount came from the Queensland government's carbon reduction program. This story is deeply concerning about all such alternative energy schemes. More and more people today are speaking out about what disasters these types of schemes have become. And it doesn't matter whether it's wind power using giant wind turbines or various types of solar projects. In this case, it involved mirrors reflecting sunlight to a common point to produce steam. But there's also solar panels that just simply convert sunlight directly to energy. There's plenty of those in California right now and in Arizona. And for all the best laid plans that the Greens have come up with to make these alternative energy schemes work, they're failing. They have failed in the past, they're failing in the current, and they will fail in the future. Why? Because they just don't make sense. In every case where alternative energy has been installed, prices to consumers have gone up. This drives economic activity down. This doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure this out. All economic activity is dependent upon energy. If you want to decrease economic activity, simply decrease the amount of energy that's supplied to the economic unit. It's guaranteed to cause us to decline. So we see that alternative energy, number one, is anti-business. It's not pro-business at all. You can call it sustainable development all day long, but it's not going to make it sustainable. Just the opposite. It's going to contract it. So controlling energy is a horrible idea, especially when we have so much abundance of energy with clean technology, I might add, at our disposal throughout the world. In America, estimates have said that we have enough natural gas energy to power our entire country for at least 200 years. And that's just natural gas. And that doesn't include potential future discoveries of new reserves. There is an abundance of coal in the world as well. And engineers have discovered how to use coal in a clean and efficient manner, decreasing pollution to practically nothing. We've also seen the development of other types of energy. Nuclear energy is one that's extremely efficient and historically extremely safe, even though there's a couple of wild examples like Fukushima in Japan that are concerning. But then again, they built that nuclear plant on a major fault line, which is rather foolish. But otherwise, nuclear energy has proven to be extremely efficient and historically safe. So we see the move all around the world to create alternative energy. We see prices going up everywhere you look. We see massive amounts of capital investment being invested in these plants that could well be put elsewhere into better projects to help people. And all we see as a result of this is large taxpayer-funded piles of scrap. My friends, this needs to stop. And not only in America, but around the world. This simply is not just an American problem. It's a global problem. And we have to thank the United Nations for bringing it to us and for spreading this garbage all around the world. The last story and the main story that I want to talk about today is quite disturbing. And again, it has to do with the green ideology. The green ideology, just to repeat, is a product of sustainable development, which is technocracy, a resource-based economic system. The idea of the Greens is to control all resources that are necessary for life on planet Earth. And in Germany, we see a very disturbing trend as the Green Party gains major traction. Now, on one hand, the globalist party in Germany, just as a frame of reference, which has been represented by Angela Merkel, is declining in influence and power in Germany. The populist movement is gaining ground. But right alongside the populist movement, the German Green Party is rising as well. And they're about neck and neck right now. There's a very good chance in the next 5 to 10 years that the Green Party will become the dominant political party in Germany. And you say, well, why is that disturbing? Well, here's why. They just announced, the Green Party that is, that they want to ban all industrial farming in Germany. If they come to power, that is their promise, that they will ban all industrial farming in Germany. And I might add, that includes all production of meat. Forget meat. They would just as soon everybody become a vegetarian and eat vegetables. But meat is a product of industrial farming, as is really all other modes of industrial farming today, because tractors and seeders and plows and harvesters, they're all necessary for a modern farming application. And indeed, Germany is a breadbasket of Europe. It produces currently inordinate amounts of food. Its exports of agricultural products are massive. And I have to add, the rest of Europe is glad to get it. But now the Greens want to ban all industrial farming. One recent candidate of the Green Party, Mrs. Göring-Eckardt, told the German tabloid Bild that public attitudes have transformed, with Germans realizing that drastic action on global warming is required. You see, that's the reason for this. Global warming is always the reason for this radical action, anywhere on the planet. She says, many people have now understood that things are going to change fundamentally. The question is whether we make the changes ourselves or allow ourselves to be swept over by the climate crisis. What we face is a monumental task which even surpasses the reunification of Germany, as it demands massive investment over a shorter time frame. Well, that's right. It will require trillions and trillions of dollars in Europe to completely rework the food system, if that is possible at all. And I will suggest that it is not. And with that in mind, I want to take you back in history to explain some of Europe's history that they should remember that they don't. But what happens when you remove food from a society? Wow, starvation. That's exactly right. Famine. There's an ugly episode in the history of Europe that happened in 1932 and 1933 in the Ukraine. This should never be forgotten, but it has, by and large. This was the famine genocide known as the Holodomor, H-O-L-O-D-O-M-O-R, There are sites on the internet now that deal with the historicity of the Holodomor. I would encourage you, just for the sake of history, if you're interested, to go look them up and read a little bit. The Holodomor was denied by Russia until just before the fall of Russia in the early 1990s. They denied it steadfastly all during those intervening years, saying it never happened. Well, it did happen. And it happened at the hands of Joseph Stalin in particular, who wanted to teach the people in the Ukraine that they needed to submit to Russia, that they needed to quit resisting the takeover of the farming land, to be put into collectives where people and farmers would simply work for the collective. And the farmers initially said, no, we're not going to do that. We're proud, independent farmers. We're businessmen. We're businesswomen. We've been here for generations. This is our land. We farm it, and we're able to produce a lot of food. In fact, it wasn't just a lot of food. The land was known at that time in the late 1920s and the early 1930s as the breadbasket of Europe. Just like in many cases, California is considered to be the breadbasket of the United States. Stalin and his followers were determined to teach Ukraine's farmers a lesson they would not forget for resisting collectivization, which meant giving up their own land, of course, to work on government-controlled farms. Moreover, the famine was meant to deal a crushing blow to any aspirations for independence from the Soviet Union by the Ukrainians, 80% of whom worked the land. It was an agrarian culture. When millions of people in the Ukraine and in the mostly ethnically Ukrainian areas of the Northern Caucasus were dying, the Soviet Union was denying the famine and exporting enough grain from the Ukraine to have fed the entire population. For 50 years thereafter, surviving generations were forbidden to speak of it until the Soviet Union was near collapse. What Russia did to the Ukraine was to heist all of their grain. They put it on trains, and they shipped it away from the farming areas. Two things happened. Number one, there wasn't anything for people to eat. Number two, there wasn't anything for people to plant in the next season. And the result was massive starvation. Estimates of how many people died during the Holodomor reach into the millions. No sure number is really known, but it could be as high as 10 million. Let me read you some eyewitness testimony of survivors from the Holodomor. Quote, please return the grain that you have confiscated from me. If you don't return it, I'll die. I'm 78 years old, and I'm incapable of searching for food by myself. That was from a petition to authorities by a resident. Quote, I saw the ravages of the famine of 1932 and 1933 in the Ukraine. Hordes of families in rags begging at the railway stations. The women lifting up to the compartment window their starving children, which with drumstick limbs, big cadaverous heads, and puffed bellies look like embryos out of alcohol bottles. Here's another. Our father used to read the Bible to us, but whenever he came to the passage mentioning, quote, bloodless war, he could not explain to us what that term meant. When in 1933 he was dying from hunger, he called us to his deathbed and said, quote, this, children, is what is called bloodless war. Here's another. What I saw that morning was inexpressible horror. On a battlefield, men die quickly. They fight back. Here I saw people dying in solitude by slow degrees, dying hideously, without the excuse of sacrifice for a cause. They had been trapped and left to starve, each in his own home, by a political decision made in a far-off capital around conference and banquet tables. There was not even the consolation of inevitability to relieve the horror. Another states, quote, from 1931 to 1934, we had great harvest. The weather conditions were great. However, all the grain was taken from us. People searched the fields for mice burrows, hoping to find measly amounts of grain stored by mice. And one of the problems was, too, if you were caught stealing food or grain in the Ukraine, you simply could be shot on the spot. So people were deathly afraid of being killed or taken away and just killed out somewhere in a field. There were so many dead bodies at one point throughout the Ukraine that the stench went up to heaven of decomposing bodies. They couldn't be buried fast enough. This was a sick example of what happens when the agricultural industry is denied the ability to produce the food that people need to stay alive. This is a history lesson that obviously is completely forgotten by the Green Party. Well, I should say the Green Parties throughout the world. They want to ban all industrial farming. If this were possible in Germany, which it may not be, but if it were possible in Germany for this to actually happen, you would see a repeat of the Holodomor from the Ukraine a century earlier. This is not the direction the world wants to go in. But I have to point out that even though the Green Party and the Green Pledge of Utopia sounds compelling, underneath you have the ideology of the anti-human, anti-civilization movement. It's far darker than green. Traditionally, green shoots coming up in the spring always signal the rising of crops, new trees, plants, flowers, and other things. In this case, there will be no green shoots. There will be only corruption and death and starvation. We might be better off calling the Green Party the Black Party, because it will bring death and destruction to people. I don't mean to imply, by the way, that every member of these Green Parties understands anything about what they're doing. They're doing it because they believe in it. They've adopted it as a religious proposition. They simply believe it. Somebody told them to believe it. They say, okay, I'll believe it. And then go do something about it. And they spout the party line faithfully to execute the policies. The fact that this program is global in nature, we see it in every continent on the face of the planet, indicates to me that there is a greater source of influence that are stimulating these people to do these things. They're not coming up with it on their own, clearly. It would be impossible. People in America don't talk to people in Germany, don't talk to people in Australia, don't talk to people in Africa, don't talk to people in China and everywhere else. They don't communicate these things. But these ideas are coming down from the United Nations, primarily. They're feeding all these people this ideology at the same time. And even beyond that, I would suggest there may well be a higher conspiracy, a spiritual conspiracy, if you will, that is anti-human and anti-civilization, that would seek to destroy the human race if it could. Those of you who are students of the Bible will understand immediately what I'm talking about. And I would suggest that you dig in with greater gusto than before to find out what all this means. But it's up to Americans, in America at least, to get involved in their own local communities to make sure that Green Party ideology does not get embedded permanently in your community. Only you can do that, and only I can do that. Washington will not save us. Our state governors will not save us. It's up to each of us in our own communities to get out and declare how wrong-headed all of this environmental wacko stuff is. And for those who cannot be persuaded, they need to be ejected, at least from public policy. You say, no, you're not going to have any more influence on our public policy. We'll vote you out. Well, it's a good opportunity to connect some dots by reading Technocracy, The Hard Road to World Order. You'll find that on Amazon.com. You'll find it on technocracy.news. And I would also encourage you, if you can, to support this work at Technocracy News and Trends and to support my work here. You can do so by going to patreon.com/technocracy and become a patron there, or you can simply go to technocracy.news and click on the donate button, which will lead you to a page where you can make a one-time or a monthly contribution directly to Technocracy News and Trends. We need your support. This is a reader-based service. We don't do advertising. We don't inundate you with pop-ups and clickbait articles and all kinds of crazy stuff that has nothing to do with our study here. So if you'd like to see this work continue to give you resources to take out to people who need to be educated, then please consider supporting us financially as well. It's greatly appreciated and greatly needed. I'm Patrick Wood for Technocracy News and Trends. See you next time.